There's some choices that we made that I probably go back and make a different choice. I won't mention any specific names. We have contracts in place. But often when we're making the choice and we're looking at the trade-offs, the pros and cons, they all make sense. But when reality hits us, we actually realize that there were some blind spots in the decision process.
Welcome to Revenue Insights. Every week, we'll be joined by revenue leaders from some of the most successful and highest growing companies. Together, we explore how they built their revenue teams, the journeys that they've been on, and the lessons they have learned along the way. Revenue Insights is brought to you by Ebster. We're a revenue intelligence platform designed to help revenue teams to build more pipeline, close more deals, and retain more customers. Hello there. You are listening to Revenue Insights. Today, I'm joined by Akira Mamazuka, VP of Global Sales Operations of SaaS at LinkedIn. Akira runs sales ops across LinkedIn's SaaS businesses and has been working there since 2014. Akira, it's been a pleasure and a journey by the sounds of it.
Absolutely. And first of all, Lee, thanks for having me. Thanks for the invitation. Yeah, very glad to be here with you.
Amazing. I have to say it's a pleasure because I get to talk to folks from all different types of industries and company sizes. I feel like everyone listening to this podcast will know about LinkedIn. So I'm very curious to dig into what sales ops looks like and what the team looks like today. Before we get into that, could you just give a little more context on your story? I know that you've been at LinkedIn for 10 years now, I think. So I'd love to hear more about how you got to where you are.
Great. I'll be 10 years in May. It's coming up in a month.
Congrats.
I'll share a little bit about my background before LinkedIn and then at LinkedIn. So my first job out of college was in consulting, spent a few years in consulting, went to business school, and then went back to consulting. Towards my second half of my consulting career, I realized one area of passion and interest was around B2B sales. So how to help B2B companies to grow their sales, to be more effective in selling, to segment, think about compensation strategies. So I started to specialize in that space. But after a long time in consulting, I realized I actually wanted to be an operator. I wanted to get my hands dirty. I wanted to build things. And that's when I decided to join LinkedIn, the sales ops team. I'm from Brazil originally. I started in the São Paulo office, covering all of Latin America based in São Paulo. It was a bit of a startup mode. The sales team had just started. We just had just built our office. And I started as a senior individual contributor role. Super fun startup mode, but also very scrappy. Had to set up really basic processes, basic reporting, helping reps work through deals, use the CRM. So really got my hands dirty in my first couple years in that role. But now looking back, those experiences, those moments gave me a lot of understanding, empathy in terms of what the role of a sales rep and a sales manager is. And I think those moments, they also gave me the foundation for me to understand the last mile of operations. And I think that foundation helps me do my job better to this day. After 2 years in the LATAM role, I had a chance to move to Europe to run sales ops for the EMEA region based in Ireland, covering all of EMEA, Europe, Middle East, and Africa. That was a super exciting time. EMEA is a very diverse region and was going through a hyper-growth mode and was a really exciting moment for me career-wise. Spent 2.5 years in EMEA. And then there was an opportunity to move up to lead global sales ops for one of the lines of business. And that's when I moved from Ireland to San Francisco, where I am currently based. So I moved to San Francisco 5 years ago to take a global role. And since then, there's been a few org changes. In my current role, I look after sales operations for all SaaS lines of business, which is Talent Solutions and Sales Solutions, close to $10 billion in revenue. I have a team that runs operations for demand generation. So everything that is related to setting targets and budget for the marketing team in terms of how many leads we expect from marketing and also sales development. Then I have another team called Member and Customer Success Ops. This team runs ops for everything that's post-sales based, including customer success and support. And finally, there's a horizontal team called Crossline of Business. That team is specialized in certain functions like planning performance, analytics, and systems and tools. So that's my current scope and where I am right now at LinkedIn.
I love speaking to folks that have really, by the sounds of it, mature operations functions. And it feels very much to me anyway, quite bespoke in terms of like, where do we need operations teams? So what was the rationale between splitting them into those teams? Was it just purely based on need?
It's been a journey. When I started at LinkedIn, the vision of the company is we had spun off several B2B lines of business. And the vision was to grow as fast as possible, both in the US, but also internationally. And the thinking was for us to grow as fast as possible on a global basis, we need to set the teams very independently, let them go after their opportunity in their own markets as fast as they can. And to do that, we set the teams very independently. So when I started, execution and decision-making was very decentralized across lines of business and also regionally. The sales ops function was pretty much generalist based. So we hired athletes, so people who could do a little bit of everything, who could run operations, who could run analysis, lead projects, were good communicators. So by and large, the team was composed of generalists. The team was also spent a good chunk of their time on operationally heavy topics like rules of engagement. We have a set of, maybe all B2B companies have that, but we have a set of rules called rules of engagement that essentially tells what a rep can do and what a rep cannot do. And as we know, sometimes reps don't work by the rules and therefore there's escalations, and sales ops back in the day had to lean in to actually resolve conflicts and disputes. So we spent a lot of time there. And from a systems and tools base, I'd say 90% of the analysis and the flows were done in Excel. We had the CRM and then everything else was done in Excel. So pretty rudimentary. So that was our starting point maybe 10 years ago. And I think since then, Lee, we've evolved a lot. I think we learned that the approach we took in our early days to set the teams very independently, it served its purpose. So we built large businesses, successful businesses internationally. But we realized that we were at a point in time when success will also come from the teams working better together, sharing best practices and even cross-selling between lines of businesses. So that notion of being super decentralized, we realized that we had to be more centralized in order to achieve that vision. Also from a resource allocation standpoint, we've become, as a mature company, we've become more disciplined financially. So we started to become a lot more intentional in terms of where we allocate our dollars, our resources. And we learned that for us to do proper resource allocation, we had to be a lot more centralized and top-down in terms of decision-making. So that was the one arc of change. We moved from being very decentralized to being more centralized and more top-down. We also realized that as the businesses became more complex and larger, we needed to move from a model where we only had generalists to a model where we have teams that are specialized in certain functions. So over time, we built teams that are only focused on analytics. So we've hired folks who are really good at building dashboards, building data infrastructures. And that team essentially builds analytics and they serve all of different teams and lines of business. We've been on a journey as well to elevate our tech stack in terms of building more scalable, structured, enterprise-grade systems and tools that goes beyond the Excel to essentially be more effective and efficient in our processes. So we built a team that is only specialized in systems and tools. So that was, I think, the second arc of change. And maybe the third one is we realized that our team was spending a lot of time, like I mentioned, on topics that we probably shouldn't be spending that much time, like rules of engagement, quota relief. So we've been on a journey to identify what are the things that can be done by a different team or even outsourced that can save a huge chunk of our team's time. So we've also moved either to other functions at LinkedIn or even outsourced a lot of those processes that I mentioned, like rules of engagement, disputes, and quota.
Just a quick reminder, and then we will be right back to the show. At Revenue Insights, our goal is to share how top-performing revenue leaders build predictable, efficient go-to-market teams. Every week, we speak to the brightest minds, and every quarter, we release the latest findings from our analysis of billions of dollars in pipeline. If you don't want to miss out, sign up to our newsletter at ebster.com/newsletter-signup. That's ebster.com/newsletter-signup. The link to make that a little bit easier for you will be in the show notes of this episode, wherever you're listening. See you there.
Incredible. How many people are in the team in total now?
Around 300 FTEs, and they are globally distributed, and they are split across those five teams that I mentioned. So Talent Solutions and Sales Solutions, the two SaaS businesses, Demand Gen, Memory Customer Success Ops, and then the Crossline of Business Ops team.
Amazing. I'm fascinated by, with that number of reps, and obviously you're trying to achieve this overarching goal of being centralized. How do you go about achieving that? How do you ensure that those different teams are aligned together?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that I'm always thinking about. So even within the last 2 or 3 years, the shape of the team has changed, has evolved. We've also been evolving our roles and responsibilities between teams. So I'd say there's, in terms of team alignment and team shape, there's two dimensions that are top of mind. The first one is how my teams align with the lines of business they are matched. And the second dimension is how my teams align with each other. And both are equally important. Starting with how my teams align with the lines of business they are mapped to. So we evolved to a model that was 100% mapped. So we, if you are a sales leader in a line of business in a region, you had a sales ops person one-to-one mapped to that leader. In the past, we were on a model that was 100% mapped. We evolved to a model that I'd call it hybrid. We still have folks that are mapped to line of business leaders or functional leaders, one-to-one. But we created teams, and I gave a few examples, that are not mapped. Teams that are horizontal. Teams whose only goal is to be the best they can be in a certain functional area. And they, those teams, they partner with the other teams. So they're helping making the other teams that are mapped more productive and successful by building a forecasting tool that works better, by improving a system or a process, by helping them with resource allocation decision. So we moved from a model that is 100% mapped to a model that is hybrid with mapped teams and teams that are fully horizontal, not mapped. That's how we have evolved in our most recent thinking in terms of how we map two lines of business. Then the second dimension that I mentioned, Lee, is around how my teams map with one another. We realized that along the customer journey from not being a LinkedIn customer, so being a prospect, to convert to a LinkedIn customer, to need some post-sale support, there's a lot of synergies in that customer journey. And there's a lot of alignment needed, both by the frontline teams, but also between my own teams. So I realized that for me to extract the most of my team and deliver most value to the businesses, I needed to create clear alignment between each of those teams to make sure that we're always finding the best practices and elevating them, to make sure that if there are synergies between teams, we are pursuing those, to make sure that if we're building something in one team and the other team is building something similar, let's be consistent in terms of what we build. And I'd say in order to achieve that sort of a connectedness across the teams, there's no secret sauce, but it's things around people, making sure that we have clearly established roles and responsibilities between teams, making sure that each individual has their own OKRs and that OKRs is available and published. Everybody know what the OKRs are. So there's a people aspect. There's a process aspect. There's process that cut across all teams, like the planning process. So that making sure that everybody's marching towards the same deadlines and we have clarity in terms of who owns what. And the final piece around technology. Making sure that whenever we're building technology, that technology serves all of the teams or as many teams as possible. So for example, we are having the process of deploying Anaplan to help in multiple use cases, including planning. So we're bringing all of those teams into Anaplan.
Wow. I'm fascinated to know, if you could wave a magic wand and go back in time, what is one thing that you would do differently?
Several things. But if I were to mention one, is related to our tech stack. However, this will sound familiar to any RevOps professional, which is their point in time in our journey, we have to make choices in terms of there's a piece of the tech stack that we have option A with certain provider, option B with another provider, option C to build in-house. I'd say most of the choices we got, I think we got right, but there's some choices that we made that I probably go back and make a different choice. I won't mention any specific names. We have contracts in place. But often when we're making the choice and we're looking at the trade-offs, the pros and cons, they all make sense. But when reality hits us, we actually realize that there were some blind spots in the decision process. And some of those decisions around our technology stack, I really like Jeff Bezos' framework on decisions that are two-way doors, so decisions that you can make and walk back from them very easily or relatively easily, from decisions that are one-way doors. That if you walk in, it's very hard to walk out of that or back out of that door. And so some of those tech stack decisions are one-way door decisions, and technology is very sticky. The switching costs are very high. So that's maybe the top one for me.
Very good one. I want to take us down a slightly deeper route. We were talking about this pre-show, but whenever we run analysis of a large number of companies all anonymized, we found that 31% of reps are hitting quota right now. So that's 69% on average missing quota. Is that something that resonates for LinkedIn, or are you at the other end of the spectrum where actually the majority are performing really well?
It's a great question. And companies, they have a different approach to quota setting. At LinkedIn, we use the 50-50 principle. Folks who are not familiar with the principle is we set a quotas at a level where we believe 50% of reps will hit, 50% will miss. That's our quota setting philosophy. It is transparent. We actually communicate to the sales organization. That's our quota setting philosophy. And by and large, we set quotas looking at our recent performance and assuming that the future, the next fiscal year performance will look more or less similarly. And then you add things like new product launches, et cetera. But quota attainment at LinkedIn, a lot of our businesses are cyclical in terms of they have a strong correlation with the economy. Think of, for example, Talent Solutions, which is a business that helps companies hire people through LinkedIn. Whenever there's a hiring boom, and we saw that through the great resignation, great reshuffle phase that we went through 2-3 years ago, there was a hiring boom and customers couldn't get enough of LinkedIn. And that's when we had probably 80 or 90% of the sellers hitting their quota in that period. We're going through a different moment now in the hiring space. We're calling it the great pause, where there's not a lot of mobility. Companies are either reducing roles or not hiring. People are not changing jobs as much. And that results in less demand for talent solutions. So we're at a point in time, I don't have the latest here, but where more than half of the reps are missing their quotas as well. So I think that's probably true for a lot of the tech sector. So it is a tough reality that we're working through right now.
If I may, to resolve that, let's say, and I appreciate setting the quota ultimately is a leadership responsibility as well, right? So I think it goes both ways where, okay, you've got a rep that might be falling short of the number that you set as a target, but equally it's the number that you set for them. Is it realistic that they could hit it, right? And what steps, I guess, are you taking to be able to rectify that?
So at LinkedIn, your quota is your quota. It's only very, very acute situations that we apply quota relief within the same fiscal year. And again, it's the bar is very high. It needs to be something like an industry shock that hit certain team hardest, or and foreign exchange devaluation that impacted certain team hardest, or a war that impacted certain team hardest. So it needs to be something very acute, and that's something that doesn't happen very often. So by and large, we don't change or revise quotas in the same fiscal year. But what we do, like I said, is for next fiscal year, if the performance in the current fiscal year was lower than expected, and as a result, over half of the reps missed their quota, we're going to be using that information to determine next year targets and quotas. So what we communicate transparently is if performance this year was lower than expected, we're going to bake that information into next year's quotas. So we're trying always to be within the 50-50 principle.
Got you. And for those folks that are exceeding expectations, that they're hitting a quota, your high performers, what would you say they are doing that sets them out from the rest?
Yeah, it's a great question. And that's a question that we're always asking ourselves. And at LinkedIn recently, we went through a process to study to understand what differentiates top performers. And we found a few traits that generally were differentiating, and that changes by role. I'll give an example for our RMs or account directors. They're the farmers. They manage existing customers. We also have reps who are hunters that are only closing up the first deal. And this example here for talent solutions, we realized there was a set of things, four or five things that those reps were doing well, really well. I'll give two examples. One was in the onboarding moment. So just close a new customer. That customer was handed to a farmer rep, so account director or relationship manager. And we found that the top performers, they do a much more robust onboarding than the rest. A mediocre onboarding would be something like, "Hello, my name is Akira. I am your new rep. If you need anything, just reach out to me." We found that top performers, they actually use the onboarding process to understand what are the customer goals are, what are the top priorities from a talent and hiring perspective, what metrics the customer will use to define success with LinkedIn. Because it doesn't matter that we do have a bunch of success metrics that we measure internally, but if that doesn't align with what the customer is expecting, it doesn't matter. So the top performers, they really use the onboarding to understand what success looks like for customers from a numerical standpoint. And they set up their relationship to be very transparent and to know exactly what good looks like. And then through the contract, contracts are either a year or 2 or 3 years. The top performers as well, they're really good at doing quarterly business reviews. And now we call it value reviews. So every quarter, they take the time to meet with the customer, having a customer success manager also usually join the meeting and have a review with the customer saying, "Let's go back to the original goals that we set in the onboarding. Let's see how we're doing against them. You said that you expected to be hiring 100 people a quarter given with your LinkedIn investment. You are only hiring 80. Is it because there's less hiring demand? Is it because your recruiting team is not fully trained in the product? Is it because we haven't fully assigned all licenses that you have?" So they use the value review as a way to get back to the original goals that the customer had, to really give a sense of, hey, we're delivering value to you and the relationship is being mutually beneficial. There's a few other traits, but those are two of them.
I love it. And when you run that analysis and you've got that information, what do you then do with it? I'm curious to understand like how you then, I'm going to assume it wasn't, "Oh man, that is really interesting." I'm fascinated how you then go and apply it, how you share it with your team.
Yeah, that's the hardest part. That's where I think most efforts of that nature, they tend to fall short, which is, okay, now I know a few things that top performers are doing that the rest are not, but how we get the rest to do the same thing. So going back to the traditional framework of people, process, and tools. So from a people perspective, there's a large enablement effort that essentially equipped all the sales organization on what we call as key customer moments. We call it KCMs, key customer moments. So we made very clear to our reps, what are the key customer moments? And in my previous example, onboarding is one, delivering a value review, another key customer moment. What are the key customer moments? And what is the expectation from you? What you should be doing? So there was a huge enablement effort to clarify the role of the sales rep, the expectations, the process they should go through to deliver against that key customer moment. And the last piece on technology, we had to actually rewire our CRM to make sure we're able to capture those key customer moments and to know the extent that reps are executing against the key customer moments, and then report to sales leadership, hold folks accountable if we're falling short. So it's been a large effort over the last year or so.
Just a quick reminder, and then we will be right back to the show. At Revenue Insights, our goal is to share how top-performing revenue leaders build predictable, efficient, go-to-market teams. Every week, we speak to the brightest minds, and every quarter, we release the latest findings from our analysis of billions of dollars in pipeline. If you don't want to miss out, sign up to our newsletter at ebster.com/newsletter-signup. That's ebster.com/newsletter-signup. The link to make that a little bit easier for you will be in the show notes of this episode, wherever you're listening. See you there.
Amazing. How do they take it? I think we kind of maybe touched on beforehand was it then kind of falls into the realm of change management. And so you're passing down, we've done this analysis, we've learned this, this is what you need to be focusing on. Do you get that conviction back? Because I feel like if I was a rep or a CSM or whatever you call them internally, I'd be like, oh, great, that's the secret to success. I know what I need to do now, but that's often not the case. So what was the receipt of it and how is it performing now that you have passed that down?
I'd say we're just completing the first year of that effort. I'd say on a scale from 1 to 5, we're probably at 3 in the change. Certainly we've seen improvement. We're starting to see now behaviors changing. We started to see the data getting better in terms of like onboarding sessions, value review sessions, but we're not where we want to be yet. So for the next phase of bringing this to life, we're considering set more prescriptive targets to the sales organization, including and then adding those targets into their performance review as inputs to their performance review metrics. We think that's another step to make sure that it is very clear that this is the expectation from the sales organization. So we're not fully there yet, but there's a set of changes next fiscal year that hopefully will take us from 3 to 4 to 5.
Amazing. Well, I'll have to reach out again and see how it's going. Final question, Akira. What is one book that you'd recommend to other revenue leaders?
I will recommend one book that is not related to sales or tech or ops, but is a book on the field of behavioral economics. It's still a relatively nascent field. It's wrote by a guy who's kind of the pope of the field, Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman. The book's called Thinking Fast and Slow. And for me, it was a life-changing book because it really distills and explains very clearly how human beings, including myself and yourself, we tend to be biased when we make decisions and when we form our opinions, and biases, many different types of biases that affect our decision-making, our judgment. But more importantly, the book offers some actionable tactics on how to be aware of those biases and how to overcome them. And that's applicable to any field, your personal life, but also to professional life as well.
Excellent suggestion. Right. Akira, it's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you for sharing as much as you have into how things work at LinkedIn and giving us a peep behind the veil. I think there's a hell of a lot more to dig into, so we'll have to reach out to you again. For anyone that maybe has any questions off the back of it, or maybe they want to connect and follow the journey that you're on, where can they find you?
On LinkedIn.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, I'll make sure that I put a link down to your profile below. And once again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Lee. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Revenue Insights. If you want to learn more, subscribe to our newsletter and we'll deliver every episode straight to your inbox. If you have any questions, feel free to connect with us on LinkedIn. Our links will be in the episode notes. See you next week.